floated the idea if you wanted to come down and
down in Texas.
Yeah, down in Texas. Yeah. In Tejas.
Yeah.
I know. All right. Well, welcome everyone.
Okay. Well, the word informal's been used, and I thought what I would do would be very informal until yesterday afternoon when I was typing up some notes to myself and things sort of fell out in a more or less sequential way. So I actually do have a little paper presentation. Won't take very long. It will assist in raising, I think, in some of the questions that are mentioned in the abstract for this workshop. So, I assume each of the workshops, as well as the keynote address, will in one way or another be attempting to answer the question posed by the subtitle, right? Is the Christian doctrine of creation compatible with evolutionary science? I assume that I, too, should venture my own answer, if for no other reason than to provoke your own further thinking. I also assume, though perhaps I'm mistaken, that most of the other leaders and speakers, if not all of them, would answer and will be answering this question in the affirmative. Sure, they would say, the doctrine and the science are compatible. I'm not so sure they are. I was upfront about this when Kelly asked me to participate. He told me my hesitations were fine. I wouldn't be undermining the efforts of the organizers if I took a somewhat different approach. As you will have noticed, the abstract for this opening workshop of mine says that I'm going to begin with the question, what exactly do we mean by evolution? That's because, as a Christian theologian, I'm in no doubt at all as to what the Christian doctrine of creation is. The doctrine is not a question, nor is it in question as far as I'm concerned. We'll get to that in a moment. In the meantime, it occurs to me that an even more basic question to ask, perhaps the question we should all be starting with, would be this. Is there any difference between asking, is the Christian doctrine of creation compatible with evolutionary science? And asking, on the other hand, is evolutionary science compatible with the Christian doctrine of creation? Think about that. I believe if you do, you will see there is a difference. Perhaps in a few minutes, I'll ask you to tell me what you think the difference is, if there is any, and what the implications might be, if any, of focusing on one question rather than the other. It's partly a question, I think, of burden of proof. Okay, think about that. But back to the Christian doctrine of creation. I'm not forgetting that we need to ask about the meaning of evolution, and I'm going to get to that here shortly. But first of all, let's talk about Christianity. I said that as a Christian theologian, I'm in no doubt as to what the religion's doctrine of creation is. And as a Christian myself, I'm in no doubt that the doctrine is true. It's easily summarized, but not perhaps so very easily understood. Here's the first and most important thing to say on the subject. Christians do not believe God created the world. Let me say that again, in case you think your ears deceived you. Christians do not believe God created the world. Where by world, just to clarify, I mean everything that exists, including but not limited to planet Earth and all its living inhabitants, past and present and yet to come. Christians do not believe God created these things. Christians do not believe God created these things. You see where I'm going? The problem is the tense of the word created, the past tense. Actually, the problem is even deeper than that. Grammatical tense itself is inappropriate to whatever it is the big G does. God, the Christian believes, is eternal, parenthesis, not I the eternal. Something I've eternal, like an angel, let's say, goes on and 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 on, never stops going on. Eternal means existing entirely all at once, not through duration. So God is eternal. That's not a big surprise for a Christian to be told that. What God is adjectivally is true adverbially of all that God does. So if God is eternal, he's eternally acting. And the only way to express that, and the expression itself is inadequate, is to say that God created, is creating, and will continue to create instant by instant by instant. The progressive present is probably the best grammatical form we can use. God is creating. He's eternally making all things, including both time and space. Time itself is a critter. There was no time before creation. I thought I might read into the record something St. Augustine has to say in the Confessions, Book 11, Chapter 13. A man may let his fluttering mind wander through images of times past, and may feel surprise at the thought that you, God, all-powerful, all-creating, the maker of heaven and earth, abstained from so vast a work for all these countless ages before you brought it into existence. Anyone who thinks like this should wake up, says Augustine. For how could countless ages pass when you, the author and creator of ages, hadn't yet made them? What times could there have been which were not created by you? And how could they pass if they'd never been in existence? Since it is by your work that all times are made, how can it be said, if there was a time before you made heaven and earth, that you were abstaining from your work? No, time itself was your creation, and no times could pass by before you made them. If, on the other hand, there was no time before the creation of heaven and earth, the question, what were you doing then, is meaningless. For when there was no time, there was no then. God, from the Christian point of view, is not at the start of some timeline, not some great cosmic finger pushing over the first domino. This is a mistake, unfortunately, too often made, not only by many Christian laity, but even by some, forgive me, Protestant theologians, who want to argue that God created the world a finite length of time ago, and who are therefore pleased as punch that Big Bang cosmogony seems to confirm this. That's just silly. I can talk more about that later if you want me to. I worry a little, as I look at their abstracts, that some of the other workshop leaders may have inadvertently made the same mistake. Looking around the room, looking for glares coming in my direction. Maybe I'm wrong about that. I guess you'll find out. Now, then there's the meaning of creation ex nihilo. Christians believe God created, is creating, will continue to create the world, not out of some pre-existing primal matter, as did Plato's demiurge, but out of nothing. But what is this nothing from which things are made? Nothing, I might note in parenthesis, is a very strange word pointing to a very strange idea. One of my favorite bits of graffiti from graduate school on a bathroom wall was a syllogism.
nothing is better than a Harvard education. Major premise. A third grade education is better than nothing. Conclusion. Third grade education is better than a Harvard education. And there is truth to that. Nothing is always a relative term. Nothing in relation to what? More precisely, the Christian doctrine is God created ex nihilo praeter deum, out of nothing but God. Or else more subtly, from the nothing that is God. Since God is no thing, no discrete object among objects. He's rather being itself, or else something more than being. As certain of the church fathers said, if God is, we aren't. If we are, God isn't. So radically different are the two modes of being. Okay, back to the question we're wrestling with. Is evolutionary science compatible with the Christian doctrine of creation? Notice that I slyly reversed the subtitle. If it is, if we're going to answer that question in the affirmative, it's because and only because we can see, or at least imagine, how evolution, whatever that turns out to mean, might coexist with the instant-by-instant arising of things from a previous state of non-being through the agency of an intelligent, in fact, omniscient creator. Actually, the word previous itself is misleading, isn't it? According to Christian doctrine, the non-being out of which things are continuously being created is not before them in some temporal scheme, but rather above them. If you'll allow me that spatial metaphor as one way of speaking analogically about a timeless state or reality. Okay, now for evolution. Here's where I will need to be instructed. I need to know how we're supposed to be using that term in these proceedings. I myself have heard the word evolution used to mean, among other things, change over time involving relatively small alterations in the size or other features of a given species. I guess we call that microevolution. Change over time involving large-scale alterations leading to the origin of new species, macroevolution. Change over time, whether micro or macro, as explained by a particular mechanism, namely the forces of natural selection acting upon random mutations. Change over time involving the descent of all living beings on this planet from a single common ancestor. I don't mean to suggest these meanings are mutually exclusive, or not at least all of them are. Now, if evolution simply means change over time, I'm on board, at least for our purposes here. I don't see any point in trotting out my secret admiration for the pre-Socratic philosophers Parmenides and Zeno of Elea, who denied the existence of time and change. But we could talk about that. So sure, let's go ahead and say there's been change over time. I also don't mind if the evolutionists in the room want to say that the time in question has amounted to millions and millions and millions of years. I would only point out that much of what is said in that regard presupposes Charles Lyell's uniformitarian hypothesis, which says that all causes now acting have always been acting at the same rate that they're acting at now. That's the only way, as I understand it, you can put any stock in radiometric dating, because you have to assume a given isotope has always been decaying at the rate that it's decaying at now, and there's no way to test that.
As for evolution, understood in macroevolutionary terms, or as involving a universal common descent, I'm more or less an agnostic. I just don't know enough. And I've read and heard too many conflicting reports coming from scientists themselves to be sure that they are themselves really sure what they're talking about, whatever poster boys like Richard Dawkins might claim. Here are two points, however, finally, that I'm not agnostic about. The first I'm almost entirely certain about, and the second I'm absolutely certain about. First, I'm almost entirely certain that science has no idea and will never have any idea as to how life arose from non-life in the first place. Even though there are people who claim, unlike Darwin, right, that evolutionary science can account not just for the proliferation of organisms, but for the genesis of the first cell, let alone the first organism, from a prebiotic or abiotic state. The arising of first life, whether on this planet or elsewhere in the universe, is, it seems to me, a huge problem for science, the solution to which may well involve, will, in my view, almost certainly involve, setting science aside as incompetent to judge, and turning instead theologically to a transcendent intelligent source, that is, the big G. And let me add, if you can't get life without God, the question of how life proliferates after it comes into being, and whether that process is compatible with the Christian doctrine of creation, rather pales to insignificance, in my opinion. Notice, by the way, I'm not even raising the question, the more basic metaphysical question, of why there is something, not nothing. While you might think this question somewhat tangential to the task at hand, I don't think it's entirely irrelevant. But again, I'm leaving that question to one side right now. Okay, that's what I'm almost certain about. That you can't get life from non-life without God. What I'm absolutely certain about, not mostly certain, but entirely certain, is that you can't get consciousness, more precisely, self-reflective, intentional, rational consciousness, in short, human consciousness, from non-conscious, non-intentional, irrational causes. Whether you take those causes to be efficient or material, these, I take it, being the only sorts of causes assumed to be at work in evolution, as defined in at least some of the ways I outlined earlier. But no, the existence of human consciousness presupposes a conscious source, a teleological origin, that is, an origin working for a purpose and with finality in mind, and capable of sharing its purposiveness and finality with human beings, however and whenever we may conjecture they first arose. In short, human consciousness presupposes, indeed proves, the existence of God. People who deny this are, worst case scenario, not fully conscious themselves, perhaps not even capable of being so. I'm afraid I have met some folks in this category. Or better case, they are people who have simply not thought things through with the thoroughness required. If that's the case, I suggest they begin by taking a look at the video on YouTube of David Bentley Hart speaking here at USC last November on the topic, the mind's eye, the conditions of human consciousness. Or, if they want something simpler but still compelling, they can read the third chapter of C.S. Lewis's book, Miracles, a chapter called The Cardinal Difficulty of Naturalism. Thanks for listening to me. That's all I've got to say for right now.